Speaking Crow, and I'm just going to click on the fact you can record me. Yes. Thank you very much to Speaking Crow. Thank you to the Winnipeg Public Library, and thank you very much to the Winnipeg International Writers Festival. It is always a pleasure to be with Speaking Crow. So today I'm going to be reading a few poems from my collection Synaptic. And as Angeline warmed us up with her terrible, terrible puns, you will know that the book starts off by talking about neuroscience. And so there's sort of two parts to the book. The first half is the sort of science poems, and the second half are more sort of traditional lyric poems, you know, with the usual I speaker and so on. So I'm going to read a few from the first half and a few from the second half. And the poems in the first half, I will show you what a page looks like. As you can see, like every poem has a footnote at the bottom. So the way, or one way, I guess, to read it is to read the title, read the footnote, so you find out what's going on, and then read the poem. Because one of the challenges with the collection was because it's about neuroscience, about which I actually know very little. Like basically everything I know about neuroscience is in this book in the footnotes. One of the challenges was, you know, how do you communicate that to the reader, right? Without the reader having to go back and forth from the front to the back of the book, right? That's not always the most enjoyable way to read the book. So I settled on footnotes, and I sort of like the tension between the sort of scientific apparatus, you know, like in a scholarly journal, you have the footnotes and so on, and then that's bumping up against the traditional lyric voice in many places. So I like that a lot. So I'm going to start off by reading a couple from the very beginning of the book, which will tell you a little bit of what's going on here. And basically, I'm thinking about a number of things in this book. One of the things is identity, right? Like, who are we? How do we know who we are? How do we understand ourselves? And one branch of science, of neurology, called connectomics, right, is designed to look at mapping the brain, right? With the idea that, you know, once you can map the brain, you can sort of map the person, right? So if we can figure out where all those neurons go, then we can, you know, understand who you are. Like your equation will be solved, kind of. And as a poet, I'm not entirely on board with that, right? As will become clear, I think, as we go along. So I'll read the poem title first, and then I'll read the footnote, and then I'll read the poem, and then we'll rinse and repeat, I guess. Okay, so I'll start off with the first poem, which is called Connectomics. The footnote says that roughly speaking, the goal of connectomics is to improve ways to map the neural connections in the brain. Connectomics. The idea is to render the brain transparent enough to read through trickles of water washing away thought. Deletions, insertions, translocations, inversions, proofreader's symbols carve a straight line to the minotaur. In the light of the laboratory, thought's skein unravels, bumpy road smoothed. Lucent, pellucid, the brain wavers like the glass in a display case, minimum interference between eye and page. Like reading through a jellyfish. The text, however, remains opaque. So the poems then sort of riff on various things that are sort of around the study of the brain in this way. And one of the things I was looking at or was thinking about or was inspired by, I guess, were some of the apparatuses and some of the mechanisms that are used to examine the brain. And that took me towards nematodes, right? Which is not really a perspective I had ever really imagined writing a poem from the, you know, from that point of view, but why not? So the poem is called C. elegans, which is the shortened form of the Latin name of the nematode. And our footnote tells me that C. elegans is Canorhabditis elegans, a small soil-dwelling nematode, was the first animal to have its genome completely sequenced. 40% of its genome is identical to that of humans. All 959 somatic cells of its transparent body are visible under a microscope. Okay, so lots of stuff about vision and transparency and being able to see and sort of grab hold of something. So the poem is C. elegans. You call us simple. On TV, innocents scream at cartoon germs, brandish cleansers, scrub us away. Grade 6 science classes learn what's living in their lashes, are traumatized for life. Still, I have what you need. Complicated, tractable, I am the ideal compromise between like and not. I'm useful because I die quickly. Your funding agencies approve. Plumbing for secrets in my glassy body, you peer through my window, seeking 40% of your soul. How age? How sleep? How want? The fundamental mysteries of biology, hidden in plain sight. The manual says, keep your samples separate from your culture. But let me reverse your gaze, turn the microscope upon the viewer. My elegant curves, the symmetries of my crystalline motility mesmerize. Rotund, rotating, I root into regions you've not been to. My eyeless face recognizes light. Hermaphrodite, I love myself. Non-hazardous, non-infectious, non-pathogenic, non-parasitic, of no economic importance, I'm nothing that you are. So then I moved on, I guess, from the animals that are looked at around the human brain to think about the ways in which the brain is sort of mapped. And one of the problems with the brain, right, is that it's all kind of squished together, right? It's like a little, it was like one of those, you know, it's like one of those foam worry, like toys, you know, that you just squeeze and squeeze and squeeze. Like your brain is that compressed all the time. So the problem is, like, how are you going to look at the brain when it's all super dense, right? So anyway, science figured it out. So the poem is called Flattened Cortex. And my footnote tells you that because the human cortex is so highly folded and layered, it is difficult to read data when it is presented in a 3D model. One way to render this data more readable is to use a computer model to flatten the cortex into two dimensions. Scientific data can then be mapped onto this flat brain. Right. So basically, it's your brain ironed flat, right? No creases anymore. So the poem is Flattened Cortex. A grand piano dropped from a window. The echoing gong of hammers on strings, all the symphonies, all at once. The ironed brain uncreases. Thought, released, collides. The palette of the color wheel collapsing into mud. Metaphors unstack. The poem is an ocean inside out. How now describe the nesting doll, the one inside that looks like you? So when I was doing the reading about neuroscience, I was also looking around for sort of, you know, accounts of strange and weird things, because as a poet, I'm drawn to the strange and weird. And I was looking at some of the experiments that people have done, right, to sort of think about, you know, the limits of the human body and like how we understand where our bodies are in relation to other people and so on. And so here's a poem called Somatoparaphrenia. And the footnote tells us that somatoparaphrenia is a condition in which patients deny ownership of parts of their bodies. Researchers at the universities of Milan and Turin analyzed what they call the rubber hand illusion, in which they stroked a rubber hand that was visible to a subject at the same time as they stroked the subject's own hidden hand. And so basically, like, if you're watching them stroke the rubber hand, you cannot tell the difference between it and your real hand. It's very hard to move your real hand because you're confused by this false object. So the question is then, like, who are you? Where do you end? Where do other people start? So somatoparaphrenia. If I believe that the hand is mine, then I must be prepared to use it. Numbness, daily insulation against others, forced touching in a packed subway car. From the other end, shouts, a woman haranguing a drunk, everyone looking elsewhere. I consider my arm. It connects me to this car as we hang off balance, swaying synchronously, or suddenly clattering together like bowling pins struck by a fast-moving ball. Reposition, reblanking our eyes. On the seat backs, grease, fingerprints, other people's hair, grotesqueries of other lives. A man lies on the floor of the car, shoes, no socks, sleeping something off. My arm connects me to the same bar everyone holds, strap around my wrist, keeping me standing. If I acknowledge that I can hook or grab or hold, then I have to acknowledge that I am choosing one of these things, the fist, the open palm. A stranger strokes someone's hand. I can't tell if it's mine. So I'm going to leave science behind. And I think turn to a couple of poems, several poems that actually are about the ocean. It's funny, like when you have a collection of sort of isolated poems, you know, you think of them as sort of discrete units. And then once they're all assembled together between the covers, then you you start to see connections between them that maybe you didn't understand were there when you were actually just sort of composing it. You start to find different ways through the collection. So this apparently has a lot to do with the ocean, I discovered in the second part here. Oceans and folklore. There are no footnotes here. So so I'll just start. This one is called Foundling. Another story. Night, a ship driven onto rock. Among the breaking timbers, heaving surge of water's giant fist, a strobing flash of lightning shows one thing that can be saved. Small package passed from desperate hand to hand, a baby. Nothing else. Anonymous parcel with no return address. Landless, nameless, face recalling features of the dead. Unmoored. That baby could be anything. From bastard prince to king, foundling, jettisoned into a future. Who will take him in? Shepherd boy or merchant, he'll sleep with animals or else on feather beds. He'll be written on or right. This story is an anchor he'll drag throughout his life, a sack he can't unpack or drop. A course between Scylla and Charybdis, one cliff the weight of fate, his rescue proof he's marked for something. The power to do good, or else destroy by accident everything he's come to love around him, moving the story forward, protagonist. Or the other cliff, the certainty of randomness, the knowledge that he doesn't matter, never did. And here's a poem called Selkie. And those of you who are up on your Scandinavian and Northern British folklore will probably know that a Selkie is, it's a water creature and it looks like a seal. And the Selkie can shed its skin and come onto land as a human. And most commonly, Selkies are female. Most of the stories are about female Selkies, but sometimes there are male Selkies as well. And the stories usually have an element of like longing and loss and love and like many good stories. So, Selkie. When a woman walks to the edge of a sea cliff and doesn't come back, they say she's gone to join her Selkie lover, which is one way to put it. If a woman cries seven tears into the ocean, it's said she'll call a Selkie from the waters. He'll shed his skin where no one sees and come by night, searching streets for sad women. There are always sad women. There are women whose salt calls out to salt, where seaweed is a wet mat before the waves pull and tumble. The body, helpless thing, bats feebly at the tide until it too is battered. When they say sad women, they mean unsatisfied. They say some women never are. Gone to join her lover. That Selkie might come back. He might be waiting, might never have left her. He might be following her everywhere. The seals know when there's someone on the cliff top. Their eyes are wet stones. In a village with a harbor, there are always sad women. Every village with a harbor guards a cliff. So I've got two more to go. And one of them comes from a trip I was lucky enough to take to Orkney, right? To Orkney Islands are in the extreme north of Scotland. And it's a very beautiful landscape, beautiful hiking around there. And one of the islands that we went to has a little sort of mini island attached to it. And the mini island has a causeway that attaches it to the mainland. And the causeway appears when it's low tide and then it disappears when it's high tide. So we went there hoping to, you know, walk out into their little mini island across this causeway. And of course, we were imagining, you know, how intrepid we were and how we were, you know, we were travelers. We weren't tourists. And so I thought I would think about those ideas when I was thinking about our trip and writing the poem, Causeway. Causeway. We parked, locked up, and then killed time, eyeing the tourists and the deserted island tempting us across the strait. The causeway, appearing only at low tide, restricted access and made us even more intrepid, turning us, we thought, from sheep to bellwethers. It was supposed to be low tide. We kicked rocks, made noise, complained, until we saw the tourists walking on water. Under the ocean's surface, the causeway shimmered as close as it would get to dry land. Picking our way across, it was hard to tell concrete from rock, nature nudged by humans. Once over, I lay in a hole made by Vikings, monks, or Viking monks, only sound the ringing in my ears until the tourists chased us out. On the island's far side, we sat and watched the guillemots make comic landings, wind flipping them up, surprised umbrellas suddenly backpedaling, looking offended. Below us was the invisible shrieking of thousands of birds. A German tourist strode towards us. "Have you seen Muppins?" Hearing no, she marched away. The guillemots continued. The causeway weighed on us. The night before, a tap had dripped, eroding any peace. This was like that, constant checking of the tide and fear that it would turn. At last, making nervous jokes, we hurried back towards the herd, relieved, anxious, not to be left behind. And I'm going to close with a Winnipeg poem, which is also a water poem. It's about the river. And I guess it's also a winter poem, but which we are heading into, as you know. But it ends with us getting into spring. So let's just keep our eyes on that. We will get there. We'll come back. And winter can be fun here, too. In winter, I really like it when the river freezes and you can walk on the river. It's like having a house where you suddenly discover there's a whole new room in it that you didn't know was there and you can go into it. And I like the river because you can look at everybody else's yard. Anyway, the river poem. It's called Winter and the River. Winter and the river becomes a right of way. Skate skiers herringbone carving the waterway's spine. Space and time combine in new perspective. From down here, you can see that the houses of the rich are crumbling, old cottonwoods falling into the stream. Still, we can't get over there, the river's altered state allowing only so much movement, ice tinted strangely, encampment or occupation. On our side, the river asserts itself, bubbling up under the bank, dry grass icicled inside the drip, drip, drip of warmer times. Spring is coming, people say. Right now, the snow's still falling, hiding footprints, voices, thin ice, shielding a sun that's slowly growing. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Thank you so much.